Okay, we are learning Malachim Aleph. We are actually in our fourth week learning this parak. We are up to Pasuk Chaf Vav, which is on page 46. Page 46, we can actually see that next to this verse 26, Pasuk Chaf Vav, it says Haftorah Teruma, which we just had that Torah reading a couple of weeks ago, because Parshas Truma, as well as this upcoming Parsha, Vayakhel and Pekudei, it discusses the construction of the Mishkan, which was a tabernacle which was in the wilderness in the Midbar, and this is very much similar to that, because it's not a Mishkan, but the Beis HaMikdash. The very first temple is being built, and we're going to see that at the end of this chapter, as we're going to see now, as well as upcoming Prakim, which we'll see shortly. So, we discussed already about how Shlomo had a relationship with Hiram, which, because of his close ties, at least Hiram's close ties with his father, David, he went up to him and said, you know, whatever you'd like, I'm more than happy to help you. And he asked for a lot of wood. Cedar wood, cypress wood, and it was specifically for the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. And apparently, they had the expertise of knowing how to chop down trees and exactly what type of wood is most appropriate for different parts of the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, that's why he engaged Hiram and all of his workers. So now we continue with Pasuk Chavav. Hashem nasan chochm l'shlamo. We're already familiar that God had given Shlomo a tremendous amount of wisdom, a tremendous amount of knowledge. He says that they were, Hiram as well as Shlomo, they were able to have a treaty between each other. They were able to see eye to eye. And as the Pasuk concludes, they made this covenant. And some people explain that it takes tremendous chokhmah to be able to see eye to eye. It's always easy to find fault in people, to be able to find petty differences between ourselves and others, and therefore we only can associate ourselves with people who are exactly like me, and anyone who's a little bit different than me is wrong. So it takes tremendous chokhmah to be able to look within a person, to be able to find the good in that person. And that's perhaps the chokhmah that Shlomo had, that he was able to befriend everyone, regardless of their differences. Ve'yal ha-melech Shlomo mas mikol Yisrael. So, for those that don't like taxes, well, sorry, because Shlomo melech needed to raise taxes, not because of a failing economy, but because he needed a tremendous amount of money to be able to build this structure, this base of mikdash. So what did he do? So some people say that he actually charged a tax, which caused, obviously, people to have to give out money. And some say it was not actually money, but rather, v'hi hamas shloshim elef ish, that the tax was actually people, like a draft. Right. He had 30,000 people working for him. And we'll see exactly why he needed so many people to chop down trees. And we did mention already that Hiram did offer that his own workers would be the ones that would take care of this task, but Shlomo realized that it's necessary for things to get done properly, that also he should have his own people, that he should be able to oversee them, perhaps also, if you want to look at it, some type of a partnership, to not lose all the control that one has by giving it over to someone else. So therefore, Shlomo felt it was necessary for him also to have his workers there too. If we, in the English, it tells us that it's, what was that? Right, it was in modern-day Syria. That's how. Right. Okay. So pretty close to Israel, where Shlomo was. And having a treaty, having a good relationship with your neighbors that border you is always a wise choice. So this is what he did. Either he had a tax with money, or he taxed people. He had people that had to work for him. Now, the fact that they had to work for him does not mean that he didn't compensate them. It wasn't for free. So a person who is in the draft, a person who's in the army, is also paid. But so that's the same thing over here. It's not that you have to work for nothing. And this is what it said also on page 47 in the English, where it says 27. It says that the levy consists of 30,000 men. So some say it was equivalent to the wages of 30,000 men. That's how much money he charged. So what's the minimum wage or the average, the mean salary? You have to look at Census 2010 to figure out what that is. And then multiply that by 30,000, that's how much money he got. 30,000 full-time jobs is how much extra money he was able to tax. Or, as we said, which is quoting the words of the Radak, the verse could be understood literally that the tax levy consisted of a draft of qualified workers. And that's what it sounds much more like, that he created this draft.
You have to feed them too.
He also has to take care of them. True, right. So maybe he also, in addition to the workers, he also had to get other money to sustain them. Now, it's interesting how he designed his day. There are a lot of people that try to figure out what's the best way to motivate your employees. Should you work them to the bone, make them work every single day, don't give them any vacation time? Well, I guess it depends on the profession. Pasuk Chavkas tells us what Shlomo did with his tremendous wisdom. Yishlachim Livanona Aser Salafim B'chodesh Khalifos. That he went to Livanona, which just translates Lebanon. He sent out these men in groups, in groups of 10,000. He had 10,000 of them go and work for 1 month, and they would be Khalifos Chodesh, Yubel Avanon. For 1 month they would be working, and Shnayim Chodashim Beveso, and for 2 months they would be home. It's a pretty good deal. So you get 8 months vacation time and 4 months work. Khalifos like to Khalifan is like to switch over, to exchange. So that's what he did. Va'adoniram al-Hamas. And this person, Adoniram, he was in charge of the tax, or as some people say, could be in charge of the draft to make sure that they're working or making sure that those people are going to where they need to be. But you can understand the back-breaking work that these guys had to do. It wasn't just an office job sitting in a cubicle. These guys were chopping down trees, which is a tremendous amount of physical labor, so hard and so taxing on a person, that he felt better you work for 1 month, and maybe there's also some travel time. So they worked a month, maybe it took a week or so to get back home, who knows. And this way they had a good month and a half just to rest from all that work, and then to come back refreshed and to be able to hopefully be productive and do a good job. So that's how it's explained over here. As you can, Rashi says this, but if you can look back on page 47, where it says in the English, it says the 30,000 men mentioned above were divided into three shifts. Each month, 10,000 men worked in Lebanon, and 20,000 remained at home. The next month, those 10,000 returned home. The second shift, the 10,000 went to Lebanon. What?
In whose home, Bevito? Is it in Beit Shlomo? It doesn't say Bevito, it says Bevito.
So maybe they're in like a large dorm or something.
Oh, they involved in the building, even in the Yerushalayim.
Bevito, in his home.
In whose home?
His own home.
In his own home.
Each one in his own home.
Because
it says... It says Berabim, Bushlacham.
But each to Beito, no, right? Each one that back home to his own home. Their own home.
To his family.
To his family.
To his
wife. Yeah, to his wife and children.
It says, Shnai Chodashim Bebeito.
I think it means that, even though it said Rabin in the beginning, it means each one went to his own family.
It could be both, right? It could be either one.
I hear what you're saying. Certainly the simple explanation is that they went home. And if you have 2 months off, no reason why you have to stick around.
They didn't want to keep them away from the family too long. That's why they did it also for this
maybe location.
Right. you hear all these problems with people that are in the military. They're sent overseas for months and months at a time. So this is perhaps that was another motivation for him to make sure that his workers were not away too long. Okay. Pasuk of Tes. Vahiyu Shlomo Shivim Elef Noisi Sabo. And when it came to Shlomo, he had so many workers. Shivim Elef, 70,000 people who are Noise that lifted up the Sabo, which Mesudas Sion says is in Masa, all the burdens. Which basically means they had to physically carry this stuff. And we said that different ways that they did this, that they would chop down the trees, and they would have the logs, they'd tie them all up like as almost like a large raft, and let them float down the Mediterranean, and ultimately get to the destination, which is where the Beis Hamikdash is. Yerushalayim is not really so close to there, but at least you can get a little bit closer. But you have these huge, huge, heavy trees that need to be carried. So you can imagine how heavy it is and how much you have to, how many people need to carry. And it's not just being carried from here down the block. It has to be carried miles upon miles and miles.
Is the Shivim Elef in addition to the 30,000?
Yeah.
Additional.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So the 30,000, to chop down a tree is hard work, but to carry the tree after it's been chopped down is even harder. So that was something which they needed to, he had to make sure they had plenty of those people.
And then 80,000 more.
Ushmonim Elef Chaitsev Bahar. And then 80,000 people that are Chaitsev, which Mesudas Sion says is a Kain Nikra. To cut down the stones from the place in which they were grown, where they originated from, so be able to cut through stones, which is obviously before there were such great tools, it was a tremendous amount of effort cutting through a stone. You can imagine this is a good couple thousand years ago, they didn't have the tools that we have now. So it took 80,000 people to be able to cut through the stones that were necessary as either the foundation or certain stones for the purposes of the Beis Hamikdash, as the wall, different parts.
Is this kind of thing for the stones, this animal that was...
Right, if you look in the English over here in the bottom left, which is a little bit of an unusual thing, but it actually is also brought down in Perkei Avos that this thing did exist. If you look on the very bottom where it says Avnei Guzis, which we didn't get to this actually in the Pasuk, but since it was brought up, it says the very last, it says there is another opinion in the Talmud that the stones were hewn not by metal implements, but by use of a small creature known as the Shamir, that was able to penetrate and crumble stones along a drawn line. All the Rashi's mention this opinion, this verse he does later on. So it's a special worm or some type of insect that was able to go on this stone and somehow was able to dig and bore holes through it. How exactly we understand how that was done, but the reason why some people say that that's what had to have been done is a question that is brought down actually in Rashi, in Pasuk Lamed Aleph. You know, we're not up to it, but we can look at it. It says in Rashi, Avanim Yikaros, the next one is Avni Guzis, which is referring to these stones that were Nifsolos Umistotos, which they were cut out and removed from the mountain. And he says, he asks the question, it's brought down, Nishma Babayas. The question is, how could you cut or use any swords or anything sharp connected to the Beis Hamikdash? There's a prohibition that you're not allowed to use anything in which has anything to do with weapons, anything which is any knives. Of course, for Shechita is different, but for the construction of the Beis Hamikdash, you cannot use any metal or anything like that. So he says, "Perish Shekol Barzel Lo Nishma Bebayis Behavnoso." That the Pasuk said later on, as we'll see later, that there was no metal that was used when it came to the construction of the Beis Hamikdash. El Shahaya Misates Mibachutz Umachnes Uban Mibifnim Kaf Nidres Pesot. So the Gemara says that the whole prohibition of using different metal instruments is only at the physical plant, the physical location of the Beis HaMikdash. Once you have all the raw materials and it's brought to the Beis HaMikdash, you can no longer use anything which is metal. Because the metal, which represents taking your plowshares into swords, which represents war, that's not the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash is only peace. It's the center of the world of Shalom. And therefore you can't have anything which is metal. So Rashi asks the question, so how do they build the Beis HaMikdash, or how do they cut these stones, rather, on the mountain, says it's not an issue, because the whole prohibition is only once it's actually brought to Yerushalayim and built there, you cannot use any barzel, any metal. However, to cut through the stones by the mountains, that's acceptable. That's how Rashi answers the question. But as it brings down, as we saw in the English, that was the reason why this special creature called the Shamir came about, so that we would not have to use metal. So some people would say that they weren't allowed to use metal even when it came to removing the stones from the actual earth, from the mountains. And again, this is brought down in Perkei Avos, in the fifth parak, that says that there were 10 things that God created on Friday, Ben HaShemashos, by twilight. Among them, for example, the donkey, Bilam's talking donkey, and we have this Shamir is also brought down among the list of 10 things that were created, which, again, obviously, what exactly does that mean? We'll talk about that when we learn Perkei Avos this year, which we'll be getting to that Mishnah in a few weeks in. So anyway, so that's how they cut through these stones. Now, the problem with the Shamir is, other than the fact that it's hard to even fathom what that was, this worm, is that why do you need Shmoinim El Chaytzei Bahar? Why do you need 80,000 people cutting through the stones if all you really need are a bunch of people with these little worms to throw all over the mountain? Unless you want to say, as it's brought down in English, that they had to make maybe some type of indentation into the stone, and therefore you needed a lot of people to do that, and then the worm or whatever it was put there so that it would be able to cut through the place that you wanted it to. So it's almost like it's almost like a hammer, that the worm, you needed a person to be able to guide it so that you'll be able to cut it in the way that you wanted it cut. And of course, afterwards, to remove it after it's cut also would require a tremendous amount of people. Okay, and that's just a simple explanation of how this was done. Okay. Pasuk Lamed, Levad Misare. So whatever it is, there's a tremendous amount of people, tremendous amount of workers that are involved over here, which obviously would cut down unemployment. Maybe we should build a Beis HaMikdash. Levad Misare Hanitzavim L'Shlomo Asher Al Hamalacha. This excludes not only all these people, but there were other people that were overseers to make sure that the work was getting done. 3,300 people. Haronim ba'am ha'osim b'malacha, that were overseeing the nation to make sure that the malacha, that the work was being done. Now, if you look in the English, actually Rashi says this, but we might as well see it in the English on page 49. When it talks about who are the people that had to carry these heavy, heavy trees, these logs. So it says on the top left on page 49, who carried burdens. These men were porters who carried the stones from the mountains where wagons could not be brought to the city. So certainly it doesn't mean that they physically carry the wood by hand the entire time, but there are certain places where there's no paths, there's no roads, and therefore they had to carry it themselves. And then you have over here which Rashi says, but reading the English, it says the 150,000 workers mentioned here were self-made converts, gerim gerurim, whose conversions were not accepted by the courts, since it was assumed that they were drawn to Judaism not by sincerity, but because of the prosperity and prestige of Shlomo's realm. So we see, actually we saw this before, that Shlomo, when he did convert certain people, like the princess of Egypt, to be his wife, he was frowned upon because during the generation of David and Shlomo, we didn't accept converts because we were concerned of their whether they were sincere about being a convert, or maybe they were just doing it because why not? It's like just walking in, becoming related to Donald Trump. Why not? Okay, I'm a multimillionaire. That's what ended up happening. Every person was affluent, were all successful. So people wanted to join the Jewish nation for maybe ulterior motives. And then if you look at the next paragraph over here, it says these converts joined the nation because they were impressed by the way that David came to the defense of the Gibeonites who had been wronged by Shaul. These Gibeonites complained to David that Shaul had persecuted them. David showed great remorse and responded by retaliating against the family of Shaul. Solomon now conscripted the Gibeonites for the labor of providing raw materials for the temple. So, even though it seems that's a little bit rude and not nice, so why would he do that? You have these people who are converted. So, the scripture is telling us clearly that it was not sincere. That's the first thing. And therefore, if we would show that they're exactly the same, then what would happen is that they would end up intermarrying and, you know, assimilating or coming within the Jewish people. And therefore, Shlomo felt an obligation to separate them to show that they are different, and therefore they were involved in this work. Perhaps, and I didn't see this anywhere, if the whole motivation of their conversion is because things are good for them, and therefore it's not an acceptable conversion, by giving them the hardest job imaginable, carrying huge logs, and then not running away, shows that maybe they really are sincere, that they really are here not just for the good times, but also for the bad, and therefore maybe because of this was on some level something of a test to see if they were sincere about really converting for the right reasons. Possible. Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Vayesav ha-melech v'yasiyu avanim gedolos avanim ikaros. So he said that the king had to command and demand that this occurred, that people would be involved in this work, and to carry these huge rocks, avanim ikaros, which Rashi says are kvedos, are heavy. Usually big rocks are pretty heavy. But yaseid habayis amigazis. And they use these stones as the foundation or to shape the base of Mikdash. Avni gozis, stones in which, as is translated over here, stones which are with hewn stones. So they were all, the foundation was created with these stones, and they were all cut proportionally to size so that they would be exactly as they should be. So you have not just the people from Chiram, but also Shlomo, Shlomo's people, and also the Givlin. They v'yifslu, as is translated in the Mesudas Sion, is inyan hashavas v'chalkas pnei avanim, that they smoothed out and cut and prepared all the stones, or as it says over here, they carved the stones. Ve'achinu ha'etzin, they prepared all the wood, ba'avanim libnos habayis, as well as all the stones in order for the Beis HaMikdash to be built. So we see, in conclusion, of how everyone was able to work together, in which was also a way of creating peace, that you can have different countries involved in the same task, and by both of the people working together, that's, again, Shlomo's chachma. Instead of him doing it all himself, he engaged other people so that they would also feel part of the process. And therefore, by them building the Beis HaMikdash, even though there's maybe political reasons you may not want the Beis HaMikdash, it's a sign of power, but if they were involved in the construction, so they're not going to be so quick to rebel against it either. So by engaging other countries and having this almost international trade and having open borders, it's a way to be able to create peace and to make sure that the peace remains. Okay.